Probably by tomorrow, if I had to guess, for those of you who are going to try to do the extra credit reports. All right, last little bit. Information for exam number 2, which is already loaded up in the system. And no, the person who didn't take it still didn't take it. They reached out to me, they made an appointment, no word. And unfortunately for that individual, I saw them in the parking lot, so I know they're on campus. So I'm going to deal with the person after class, and I'm going to post your grades. Because at this point, they deserve a 0. All right, so we were talking about the general court. And I talked about the leaders, talked about the rules. There we go. We did the rules. And what we got to deal with today is we got to deal with the different committees and how a bill becomes a law in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. All right. What are the 3 primary jobs of the legislature? All legislatures. What do you got?
Come up with like ideas for laws and stuff.
So you're going to pass laws. What else?
Like they also work as like a check and balance for the other powers, right?
Okay, yeah, that's one I hadn't thought of, but yeah, the check and balance. Anything else that they do? Representatives of the people make policy, pass statutes. 3rd is oversight. Their job is to oversee the state bureaucracies. And I'm making it plural because it's the same is true in all 50 state legislatures. And how they do it is with committees. Committees that are created to control specific subject matter areas. Now, not that I'm going to require you to remember every single one of the committees that are currently operating in our general court, but if you are interested, you can find information at malegislature.gov/committees. So masslegislature.gov/committees. Now these committees, again, these are where the work of the legislature is done. This is where they address the areas that the legislature is in charge of. So as I've mentioned, I got a law passed, a local law passed for some, a special act. And I actually had to go to a committee hearing, and I had to present, you know, why Sutton was pushing for this law. I actually had to go 3 times, but it was fun. I like doing it. Now, Massachusetts is different. All the states are different from one another, but Massachusetts is kind of unique. In that, as I said last class, much of the work is actually done together between the 2 chambers. But as far as types of committees, there are 4 types. And we're going to cover all 4. The key thing to remember is that each type controls jurisdiction over a defined area. So again, if you look up the committees, it's all in the names. There's healthcare, there's economics, there's public transportation, all of the different divisions. The first type in Massachusetts are known as standing committees. Standing committees. Each chamber has its own standing committees. At last count, there were combined 44, although I think a couple of more have been added since the last time I updated my notes. 44, there are individual committees, but there are also committees that are joint committees. Obviously, the joint committees are, you have House and Senate representatives sitting together. Of the 44 committees at my last count, there are four that I want you to know, because there are four that are not only joint committees, but they're the most important and most powerful. The first of the four is a committee called Bills in the Third Reading. Bills in the Third Reading. This committee considers all bills that have made their way through the legislative process. And the job of the Bills in the Third Reading is to proofread the bills. So essentially, their job is to read them, examine them, make sure that there are no grammatical errors, make sure the constitutionality is present, and to make sure there's like no duplication. This committee is important because once a bill gets out of this committee, it's just about done. It's almost on the cusp of becoming a law. The second committee. And this one you sometimes hear about in the news is the Joint Standing Committee on Ethics. The Ethics Committee deals with the questionable behavior of the membership. If a representative or a senator does something that's questionable in terms of conduct, it's the job of the Ethics Committee to basically investigate and impose potential punishment. Now, the Ethics Committee does not have the power to kick a member out, but the Ethics Committee can recommend that a member gets removed from committees. I'll give you two examples of questionable behavior that I can think of off the top of my head. The first was with a senator. I wish I remembered his name. He was from Worcester. He got caught using the State House computers to watch porn. In there, there's a good lesson. If you have a work computer, only use it for work. But he would regularly use the State House computer and watch porn and share porn files. And I don't think there was any kiddie porn, but if I remember correctly, it was big. It was nasty what he was doing. But he got caught. The Ethics Committee investigated it. And as the investigation was going on, it was all talked about in the news. He was so embarrassed. He ended up resigning his seat. He stepped down. The other one is more recent, and it impacted my friend, Senator Ryan Fatman. Ryan Fatman was accused of inappropriate campaign spending, and he was investigated by the Ethics Committee. Well, as it turned out, legally he did nothing wrong. But the Democrat majority went on a partisan witch hunt and attempted to drag him and his wife, Stephanie, who is the Register of Probate, their reputation through the mud in hopes that they would potentially lose an election. Both of them ended up winning, but because of the investigation and the findings of the Ethics Committee, they had to pay a fine. So always be on the lookout. If you hear about a representative or a senator that gets themselves into a little bit of trouble, in the news story, there sometimes is reference to the Ethics Committee. Another powerful committee you may hear about? Rules Committee. Now, the Rules Committee has no impact on the rules of operation. What the Rules Committee does is it basically controls the scheduling of the bills when they get ready to go to the floor for debate. To a degree, the Rules Committee kind of controls the calendar. But they have the power to put special conditions on bills. So maybe there's a need for emergency funding. You know, the Rules Committee can basically say it's going to jump to the head of the line, you know, to be the next bill for debate. And the last one is the most powerful one of them all. The Ways and Means Committee. Anything dealing with money, be it taxing or spending, any bill that deals with money in any way, shape, or form, go through the Ways and Means Committee. Now, the Ways and Means Committee is a joint committee, but unlike all of the other joint committees, the Ways and Means Committee does meet separately. I guess we could kind of think of them almost like subcommittees. This committee is so important that the Senate president serves as the chair for the Senate Rules Committee, and the Speaker serves as the chair for the House Ways and Means Subcommittee. This essentially means that the President and the Speaker together essentially control the purse strings. And again, this is not meant to be partisan, but it's a reality. Because the Democrats have a supermajority, basically the Senate President and the Speaker of the House can get their members to pass anything that they want. FYI, the same is true in those states like Utah that are overwhelmingly Republican. All right, questions? All right. Of the 44 committees, most of them are joint standing committees. The general court have been using joint committees since the 1830s. Because way back when, they decided the best way to speed up the process. Again, we are one of the few legislatures in the country that is a full-time legislature. They are open around the calendar. So because so many bills are debated, so many bills are filed, They figured out back in the 1830s, the easiest way to make it go quicker is to have joint standing committees.
What do I got? 33, it looks like I have written down. There are 33 joint standing committees.
The makeup for each of these joint standing committees is the same. 6 senators, 11 representatives. 6 senators, 11 representatives. And each has joint chairmen, chairpersons. There's a Senate chair and there's a House chair. And the chairs are named by the chamber's leaders. So the Senate president names all the chairs for the Senate committees, and the House speaker names all the chairs for the House committees. And they truly operate as joint committees. Meaning when the committee meets and they vote on things, every member gets a vote, whether they are in the Senate or the House. But again, in Massachusetts, the vast majority of the committee people are Democrats. Questions? The hearings are always open to the public. I said that last class. If there is something going on that is of interest to you, as I said, you literally have the ability to go check it out, to go see what's going on. But again, the catch is, like I said, you got to get there earlier in the morning. If you want to speak on a topic, you should contact your representative or your senator and they put you on the agenda. You show up, you sign in, and you wait. So of my 3 trips to get my special act pass, once I had to sit there, I got there at like 9 o'clock in the morning and I had to sit there till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Another one, I got there at 9 o'clock in the morning. I think I was able to speak right before lunchtime. And then the third time I went, I got to speak first. So it was nice. And if you are a scheduled speaker, once you speak, you can leave or you can sit there and hear the other items. Now, the committees do hold executive sessions. So public hearings are when they're trying to do fact gathering. They have speakers, they have presentation of evidence. But when the committee meets as a committee to vote on whether to approve a measure, they do that in what's known as executive session. Those are behind closed doors. And members of the public are not allowed to attend. All right, so we got standing committees. We got joint standing committees. The third type of committees that I want you to be aware of are called conference committees. Unlike a standing committee, which means it's a permanent committee, it always exists. A conference committee, very, very short in duration. The job of the conference committee is simply to take the House version of a bill and a Senate version of a bill and slap it together.
when we do how a bill becomes a law, we're going to see there are two different versions of any bill traveling through the general court. But once they go through the process, and there's a House version and a Senate version, before it become a law, the two versions have to be combined. They have to be reconciled. And that's the job of the conference committee. So there are conference committees for every bill that gets passed. They exist only so long as it takes to iron out the differences. Typically, there's three members. Two reps, one senator. For every bill. As soon as they do it, that conference committee ceases to exist. And then the last type of committee are temporary bodies established to study specific subject matters. And they are called special committees. A special committee could be created in either the House or the Senate. You know, maybe the Speaker wants to look into the costs of adding new microphones into the House chamber. Well, he would create a House special committee for that purpose. They would fact find, they would put together a report, they would present it. And then as soon as they presented the report, they would conclude. Or if it's something big, you know, maybe need to pass new regulations to deal with how charter schools are created, for example. Well, in those instances, there might be a joint special committee, because maybe the Senate wants to get on that as well. So basically what I'm saying, either chamber has the ability to make a special committee for any special purpose at any time. And typically, like I said, once the work of the special committee is completed, then it ceases to be. Questions? All right, two other elements of the general court that I want you to be aware of. One, unlike town government, municipal government, when we get there, municipal government is nonpartisan. If you're going to run to be on the school committee, if you're going to run to be on your planning board, you ever want to run to be on your select board, you don't run as a Democrat or a Republican. You run as yourself. It's nonpartisan. But state level, everything is partisan. And of course, as I said, in Massachusetts, it is overwhelmingly controlled by the Democrats. In fact, I actually have the date. The last time the Republicans controlled a majority in both chambers was 1954. That's even before my time. The worst year for the Mass GOP, and by the way, the Mass GOP is awful. Awful political party. And I'm saying that as a Republican. The worst year for the Mass GOP, I remember, it was 2008. That was Mitt Romney was still governor. That year, Mitt Romney decided he was going to campaign, now Democrats, against members of his own party. And that year, out of the 200 seats, only 20 Republicans won office in both the House and the Senate. That was bad. But since then, my most recent numbers has it at 20, 30. I got it at about 30. I don't know if how accurate that is. I'm pretty sure there are 5 Republicans out of 40 in the Senate. And I have 25 in the house, but I don't think it was that low. I think it was about 30, but whatever.
FYI, in the standing rules for both chambers, unless either party has one-third of the seats, they can't challenge any of the proceedings. So,
whether it's 31 or 32 or 28 in the House, it doesn't really matter. The Republicans are pretty much insignificant. So what does this mean? Well, if you took U.S. government, you took civics in high school, you know it's in our Constitution the same as in the U.S. Constitution. If the governor vetoes a bill, that veto can get overridden by a two-thirds vote. Well, when we had Charlie Baker as our governor for 8 years, every single veto he tried was overridden. Wasn't even close. But that's the type of government that the people in Massachusetts want. So, as I always say, the people get the government they deserve. Will things change? I don't see 2026 as being a good year for the Republicans in Massachusetts. So, who knows?
Like I said, I would have no problem if the Republicans were in the minority, but if we were a purple state. You know, because if we had enough where you could have compromise, you could have discussions, we'd all be better off.
All right, compensation. Compensation. As required by the Constitution of the Commonwealth, our state legislators receive compensation. They are paid. But here's the interesting thing.
Thanks to Article 118,
or Amendment 118, the 118th Amendment, the salaries of our state legislatures are tied to the overall median incomes of the residents of Massachusetts. So, they can only get an automatic raise if the median income goes up. But there have been a few years, like during the recession that hit us in 2007-2008, that because of this amendment, their salaries actually went down.
Questions on that?
In addition to their salaries, they get stipends. They get extra little line items of money. And the stipends are linked to leadership positions. So, the committee chairperson or a subcommittee chairperson,
they get stipends up to $35,000 extra. If you're just a committee person, you too get a stipend.
But that's about $7,000.
They also get
allowances. Parking. They get gas reimbursement. They get food reimbursement.
All nice little sweet house type of nuggets.
Obviously, the members that drive the farthest, they get the highest allowances. So if you are representatives from, say, Williamston or Adams or North Adams, you know, you got to figure to drive into Boston to go to work, you're talking 3 to 3.5 hours just to get in to the general court. You're talking roughly 170 odd miles one way. So yeah, you get to put in for an extra little bit of money,
little boost that goes into your pay. By the way, it could be upwards of $23,000 extra, depending upon how far away you live.
So you got to figure, a member gets a base pay, I think it's about $75,000, plus you tack on the stipends for your committee appointments, and there are many members that sit on multiple committees, plus you get your allowances, plus you get your transportation and all the rest.
If you ever considered running for the general court, you'd definitely be making six figures. The highest two wage earners are obviously the Senate president and the speaker. The speaker, so the Senate president, the current Senate president, she makes about $195,000 a year, and the speaker, $196,000. So they make a pretty good living, that's for sure. But it's required by law and the Constitution. Questions? All right, next up, and I wouldn't be surprised if this in itself was an essay question, all by itself. And by the way, I believe the graphic is on my website. What's going to pop up? I'm pretty sure. Let me check before I talk. Wait, I don't want to close that. CX1ProfitMag.com. PSC 221 down at the bottom. Yep, I do. General court bill to a lot shot. So that's there.
All legislation, all statutes begin with the filing of a document called a petition.
A petition. Now, according to the state constitution, and I quote, any citizen or group of citizens may petition the general court for legislation on any subject.
So, like me, you too could potentially get a law passed.
But here's the catch. You may petition, but it must be endorsed by a member of each chamber.
So your bill has to go through your representative and your senator. What they essentially do is they sponsor the bill. If you don't get sponsorship, your petition dies. Questions on that? Now, here's an interesting thing, and this is one of the exceptions that only exists in a handful of states. A petition can also be recommended by the governor, by the attorney general, by the secretary of state. Any state officer. Petitions can also be recommended by any commissioners, any heads of any of the state agencies. Well, what is the executive branch doing recommending laws? Well, they are citizens too. And that's the technicality. That's what allows them to do it. Our Constitution says any citizen of Massachusetts may. So that does include elected officials. But like if you were to do it, even if the governor wants a law passed, the governor has to get sponsors to sign on. One last little nugget. Just like in the Congress, a bill can start in either chamber, except for revenue bills. Why? Why do all things with money have to come from the House of Representatives? U.S. history. No taxation without representation. So in Massachusetts, in the U.S. Congress, in New York, Nevada, every single state legislature that has a bicameral legislative body, anything dealing with money must start with the House of Representatives. All right. Here we go. Let's have some fun. Here's how it works. And this is on the website. Let's zoom in. So what we're going to do, just to make it easy, is that we are going to follow a bill that originates in the Senate. That's the black arrow. All right. It begins with a petition. A petition is filed by the office of the clerk, or in the office of the clerk. It must be brought in by a member. So again, we're starting in the Senate, so it must be brought in by a senator. They must put their name on it as sponsor. All it takes is one sponsor. The clerk takes the petition, prints it on the official form that all petitions must be printed on, and then refers it to the appropriate committee. It's put on the right piece of paper, goes to the Senate. Now, by the way, since most of the committees are joint, that sometimes mean that the moment the petition goes to the Senate, it also goes to the House. Because it can't go to a joint committee unless both chambers are aware. So to get from the Senate to the House, that means there must be a representative. That is a sponsor of the bill. One sponsor, gets to the joint committee.
As we said previously, in the joint standing committees, that's where the hearings are held. Notices are sent to the petitioners. Any interested party may testify either for or against the bill.
And once all of the hearings conclude, the committee then meets in executive session. Where they take all the findings from the hearing. And they transform the petition into a bill by marking it up.
Marking it up includes the committee putting its recommendations. It includes putting changes, basically starting to flush it out.
Once the bill is marked up, the committee then votes. Are we in favor of it or are we against it? If the committee reports it favorably, that means it goes back to the chamber that it originated in. So we're going to stick with the Senate.
The key is it must be reported favorably. If it is reported as being unfavorably,
when it goes back to the chamber, it has a tendency to get shredded. But at this point, when it gets back to the Senate after it's marked up, it's considered to be read in the first. So the rough draft is reviewed. Now, FYI, if it has anything dealing with money, it goes to Ways and Means. And Ways and Means weighs in on it.
If the Ways and Means reports on it favorably,
it then goes to the calendar. Once it's on the calendar, it will go before the full Senate. And the full Senate has the ability to debate, to weigh in on the merits of the bill. That technically is the second reading. If the majority of senators are inclined, kind of like the way it looks, It then gets reported to Bills on the 3rd, where they review the bill. And they make sure all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. If it is approved, it then goes back to the full Senate for a third reading before the chamber. At this point, they take a final vote on the Senate bill. If they are in favor of it and it passes, I will bring this up because you can't see it, and then I'll go back. It then becomes engrossed. So three readings. Then engrossed.
The engrossing division places it on engrossment paper in accordance with general laws. In other words,
the bill number, or the Senate version of the bill, is printed on the paper. The sponsors or co-sponsors are reported. The initial petitioner is reported. And it usually references, was it passed out of committee? Was it passed by the third bill? Bills in the third reading committee? Was it passed by the whole body?
By the way, engrossment is the final step before it's going to become certified. But here's the catch. Notice the arrow. See? Once the Senate version gets engrossed, it goes all the way back to the House floor.
Where the House takes up the Senate bill and decides if they like it or if they want to change it. Of course, if it's money, it goes to Ways and Means. If it's kind of roughly approved, then it goes to the House floor, gets put on the calendar. All of the members get to debate the bill. Depending upon how it goes, if roughly approved, it goes to the House Committee on Bills in the third reading. I's dotted, T's crossed. Goes back to the floor of the House where it's voted again. And if it's improved, boom! It goes to the House Division of Engrossment, where the official House version is passed.
And this is where conference committees come in. Because chances are, if a bill started in the House, when the Senate gets their hands on it, they're going to change it. Or if a bill starts in the Senate and the House gets on their hands on it, they're going to change it. Sometimes they add amendments. And the amendments sometimes don't even have to be anything to deal with the bill. They could just be riders, they're called. But once it passes through both chambers, we're getting close to the finish line. That's when our aforementioned conference committee is called. They take the House version and they overlay it with the Senate version. They kind of shake it all out. Because they can't have two versions, they only can have one version of the bill. They then take the final version and it goes to the engrossment division. There's no more House version, there's no more Senate version.
There only is the general court version. If it gets to that point, all bills first go to the House for the Speaker's signature. And then once the Speaker signs it, it goes to the Senate President. The Senate President has the final say. If the Senate President refuses to sign it, it's dead. But if the Senate President signs it, and again, just giving you the reality, partisanship, they're all Democrats. I've never heard of a bill that the Speaker signed that the Senate President didn't. Once it gets there, it then goes to the governor's desk. Questions? Here is the catch. We'll cover this when we do the governor's, which is next, our next topic, first topic for the third exam. The governor has 10 days to decide what to do. 10 days. The governor can do a couple of different things. Gov. The governor can sign it. If the governor signs it, bill becomes a law. Typically, 90 days after the signature is affixed. But the governor also can change some of the language. The governor actually has the power to amend it. If the governor makes an amendment, guess what it has to do? The amended version has to go back to the chamber that it originated in. And they have to decide, do we want it or not? Because our hypothetical is a Senate bill. If the Senate approves it, it then goes to the House. If the House is okay with the amendment, then they approve it, and then the amended version becomes law. Or the governor can veto.
The governor has the authority to veto.
Now here's the catch. The governor cannot just take out a veto stamp and say, no! The governor must use what's referred to as a qualified negative veto. Meaning, the governor is obligated to tell the legislature what she does not like about it. But our state constitution does say that if the governor attempts to veto a bill, it goes back to the chamber that it originated in, and they can vote to decide if they're going to override it. Where approving a return bill with amendments takes a majority, To override a veto, it takes 2/3 vote. The speaker and the president tries to do the vetoes at the same day, on the same day. But it doesn't always happen. So sometimes the chamber where it originated from votes first, say in the morning, and then the other chamber does it in the afternoon. The last unsuccessful attempt to override a gubernatorial veto in Massachusetts I can't remember. Maura Healey hasn't vetoed anything that's come out of the general court. Charlie Baker tried a couple, but his vetoes got overridden. Oh, God, I can't remember. What was his name? The governor was before then? Got a brain fart. Yeah, I can't remember the last time a veto was not successfully overridden. All right, whatever. Well, the last option, the governor chooses not to sign it. But in Massachusetts, we do not have pocket vetoes. So if the governor chooses not to sign it, by default, on the 11th day, it becomes law.
It's as if the governor signs it.
And of course, FYI, our Constitution states that any law that passes through will go into effect 90 days after the governor signs, unless there's an emergency situation. The last time a governor declared it was an emergency situation is what Maura Healey did with the last gun law that passed. She ran through, made it automatically enact because she was terrified at the fact that the people that are gathering signatures for the ballot question to override it had far exceeded the statutory requirement of signatures to be collected. I think they needed to get like 45,000 signatures, and I think they had close to 90. So, if she did not do that, the collection of the signatures for the ballot question would have put the law on pause until after the voters decided. But she decided she knew better than the voters. She enacted it. So if the ballot question passes, in theory, that law goes away.
I'll be honest with you, I can't remember any time a governor did it in my attentive years. So going back 30 years where a governor declared an emergency and needed to fast track a bill. But if you do a Google search, I'm sure there are other examples. I just can't think of any. Questions? Yeah?
When like the governor doesn't sign and it like gets enacted, like, 10 days later?
10 days later.
Yeah. Like, why would a governor not want to sign?
Charlie Baker did that a lot.
Like, just, like, have his hands clean? Like,
yeah.
He's waiting for it?
Yeah, yeah. That's what, and he would frequently hold press conferences.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I wasn't in favor of this bill, so I didn't sign it. Well, then why didn't you really make a stand and, like, veto it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, why that was put in there? Interesting example.
What the founding fathers used to do to avoid politically sticky situations is they would literally get on their horses and ride in the countryside. They just got to run away. Most recently, the Democrats in Texas did that. They bailed on, you know, their duties for the state house in Texas. Some of them went on a grand tour. Before that, the Republicans in Oregon did that. You know, because if you can't get a quorum, you can't take action. Mm-hmm. Well, there are also instances back in the day where, you know, the governor was just like, well, I refuse to do it. And if the governor never signed it during the colonial period, it just, nothing ever happened. Just died. So John Adams felt one of the best ways to, hey, if the representatives of the people really want a law passed, it should be passed, to get around it was to put that clause in. Does it happen often? No. But again, it's those political hot potatoes. Because if the Democrats, for example, pass something that's, you know, the Republicans are all against, is a Republican governor going to risk their political future by putting their names on it? Mm-hmm. So that's what I did last night. So that way, if anything bad happens with the state, I can turn around and say, I didn't vote for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm up on stage, and I let it be known.
Other questions?
What if an amendment was not approved?
Then, all right, if the governor's amendment was not approved, they then would push it towards an override. So if they're going to go along with the governor's amendment, a majority. If they're going to reject the amendment, essentially what they're doing is they're going to override that change. And that would take a two-thirds vote.
Any other questions? All right, now here's the kick. This is how it's hypothetically going to work on the exam. It's going to be the extra credit question. And the more details you give, the more points I will award. If you're able to get all of the major points, I will give you perfect score on it. If you're able to stitch in some of the small details, I will add extra points in elsewhere on the exam. I can't add more to a 10, but if you've got a couple of questions wrong, I may mark them right. So I will reward with extra credit if you give me a good response on. And I will get the recordings up because I got to go back home before I go meet with my client. So I'll make sure this is up online for you to review tonight. All right, real quick, the last little bit. I don't necessarily remember if I have any questions dealing with this, but I'm just going to wrap it up real quick. Obviously, the 200 elected officials that work under the Golden Dome don't do everything themselves. They actually have a huge staff that works in the building. And there are some employees that work for the general court. And there are some employees that work for the individual members. Obviously, any agencies require support staff. And the support staff could be something as simple as, you know, the custodial staff that cleans the buildings, the maintenance staff that makes sure everything's working, the security guards, you know, that check you when you go into the building. They actually have a store inside the legislature where you can go and buy books or other interesting little like trinkets, gift shop. And that was the word I was looking for. So anybody that works in the building is technically considered a support staff for the operation of the building. Each branch also has clerks. These are the head officers that are responsible to make sure everything is recorded. They are the top career employees for the general court. And the clerks themselves are people who usually start as teenagers and have been working there for decades. Unfortunately, I don't have the current clerks. The last clerk of the Senate I have was a guy by the name of William Welch, who was from Milford. He was appointed clerk in 2004. He may still be clerk, but I doubt it. But he had been working in the general court since 1973. So that's 27, 31 years of service. And then he was given the highest official position. So what do? Like I said, they make sure everything is filed correctly. They make sure the calendar is posted. They make sure that the sessions take place when they're supposed to take place. Make sure everything is posted correctly on the website. So that way, everyone will be informed. Every individual member has aides. Some are paid. Some are interns. The paid staff gets paid, even though they work for a specific legislator, they get paid by the general court. They get state retirement, for example. I'm so proud to say my nephew just got hired this summer. He's a legislative staff member for Senator Fatman. He goes to college. He's making, I think, like $50,000, and he's already paying into the state retirement system. So when he gets out, as long as he works there for 2 years, he's going to have that pension, a little bit of pension, state money, until he dies. It's a good gig to get if you can get it. The job of the aides is obviously to do all the work for the legislatures. So they're the people who run the offices. They're the ones who run back and forth to let the individual legislator know when a bill is coming up or where they got to show up for. Sometimes they help with rallies or other things like that. Sometimes they meet and greet visitors. Whatever the legislators need to do. Although the interesting thing is they also typically write the speeches as well. So if you ever see a legislature, you know, up on the stage and they're giving a speech, you can thank their aides for writing it. The three other positions. There's also a division called the Legislative Service Bureau. The Legislative Service Bureau technically falls under the Committees of the Rules. To make it very simple, the job of the Legislative Service Bureau is to make sure all of the computer systems operate. The list of committee hearings are posted, that the members are aware that there's a committee hearing, where they're going to be located in the building. They're also required to print all of the general laws. There's a sergeant in arms. Sergeant in arms is the literal gatekeeper. They must be present at the beginning of every session. And they're also the oversee the security in all of the pages. The individual runners that work for each chamber. There is a Senate sergeant in arms, and there is a House sergeant in arms. Interestingly enough, the Senate sergeant in arms, in order to get into the Senate, where the Senate offices are, you actually have to go through a door, and the current Senate sergeant in arms, she's a woman, I can't remember her name, but she literally sits at the door. She checks your ID. She asks, like, why are you there? She was pretty nice, though. In the last two offices, there's legislative data processing. They do all the clerical work. They maintain the financial information system that's available. They work directly with the state, Secretary of State,
because they transmit all of the data for permanent recording.
And last but not least is the Legislative Post Audit Bureau. Now, here's the interesting thing, and I'm glad I ended on this. How many of you were able to vote in 2024? Did you vote on the ballot questions?
Yeah.
Remember the audit that 73% of Massachusetts voters voted for? The Legislative Post Audit Bureau is overseen by the state auditor. The job of this bureau, they're supposed to audit the books of both chambers. But since 1994, neither the House nor the Senate have allowed the Audit Bureau to fully audit the books. That's what prompted the state auditor to put the ballot question forward. So that way the state auditor could reestablish the authority to check the books of the general court. Because it only makes sense that the auditor, whose job it is to audit, knows if the legislature is actually spending money according to the law. And this is my last axe that I grind all the time. At the municipal level, every single city and town must post a budget. So when you go to your own town meetings, if you go, you get the book in the spring. That's the town book. And in the book is a line item with every single dollar that's spent. It says exactly who got it, where it went, and so forth. Full transparency. That's required by law. But there is no state law that requires the state government to be transparent.
I think it was Article 1 where all the budget was kind of set, right?
Yeah.
There was data processing that was in there. I didn't see that. And I don't think that was discussed. Was that discussed?
Oh, in our meeting?
Yeah.
No, what that was is we took some free cash and we had to purchase some additional capital items. So the line item, when I read the motion, what I was referring to was our capital item article that was in the spring. That's where we buy like our trucks, our plows, our computers, stuff like that. So what we ended up doing there, we bought new Chromebooks for the school teachers. We're buying a new roller, a hot top roller, I don't even know what you call it, a steamroller type thing, one of those. We had to buy a couple of trailers. There were just some additional items that we added.
It was like $20,000, right?
Yeah. No, it was about $200,000.
Well, no, in total it was $200,000.
Yeah.
But like, there was like, they said increased data processing. They said it twice. Hopefully it was $10,000 or something. But I don't know what it was because I was trying to like, what it meant.
I'm trying to remember what that was. That wasn't the backup drive for the police department. That was its own article. What was that?
I literally couldn't find it. So
I have to go back and I have to look. We did talk about it. I just don't remember what it was. I don't remember if that was town hall related or if that was school related. Good question. I'll get back to you on that one. All right. So our time is up. Test will open at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. The person who did not take the test is not here. So I'm going to go home and I'm going to give them a 0. So your grades will pop up. Like I said, almost everybody that took the test the first time did well. Some people did really well. I think you'll overall will be happy. When you're done with tomorrow's test, I'm going to try grading it as quickly as possible because I think midterm grades are due. So your midterm grade, if I can get your grades graded, will be the average of the first exam and the second exam, which roughly constitutes 30% of your final grade. And lastly, I did open the Dropbox for the paper. I remembered how to add it, so that's there now. So if you're almost done with the paper, and what did I say, like November 10th or something like that,
If you're able to drop your paper beforehand, I'll add 10 points to it. All right. Good luck with the exam. If you have any issues, send me an email. Will, you too. So you said you graduated 2004? 24.
All right. Yeah. So sophomore year right now in college.
Oh, all right. Very cool. Did you do, were you one of the kids that came here and took some of the, like the advanced college classes?
No.
Oh.
I came in because they passed the mass educate thing, so it's really cheap, so it's worth it.
Nice. Oh yeah, 2 years of college.
Right.
At low cost. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah. So it's cool. Like a logical choice.
Yeah.
I have a question about the exam.
Yeah.
So the last exam, the essays were like put in maybe like halfway through.
It's just random. Yeah.
So.